Hey, welcome to the Throwback Thursday edition of the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. As always, delighted to have you with me one more time. I like doing these TBT episodes because it gives me a couple of things to kind of work off of. It gives me a chance, first and foremost, to dig into the vast, and I mean friggin' vast, audio archives of the shows that I've done for going on 23 years now. And this actually started, this particular episode, because Lee Iacocca passed away a week ago. And I was certain that somewhere in this deep well of audio history that I have, that I had a tape, a cassette tape. You've heard of them, you know, in between the A-track and the CD, it was a little cassette. And if vinyl's making a comeback, I think then we're going to start seeing cassettes, don't you? I mean, really? Right? It could happen. So hold on to those. I literally have thousands of them. Anyway, when I heard that Lee Iacocca had passed away, in my mind, this little file drawer opened up and said, I have a tape somewhere of an interview that I did with Lee Iacocca years ago when he had a book come out. Where is it? And so I'm off to the Rubbermaid Valhalla, which is where all this stuff is stored, and it's not in any particular order. And I don't know that I could ever put it in any particular order. They're not alphabetical. They're just in piles. So on one hand, it's not very organized. On the other hand, it is so cool to go diving in there, better than a dumpster. But I go in there and name after name pops up in these people that I did all these shows with. And I don't remember, obviously, all of the conversations. That's not possible. But I'll see a name like Roby Lester Eccleston. Roby died probably 15, 18 years ago. And Roby was a contract person with Walt Disney way back in the day. You know, she would do voices and singing and things like that. She was actually the voice of Mrs. Claus on Santa Claus is Coming to Town. You know, the animated thing with like the little puppets. She was just a delightful human being. And I saw her tape with her name on it. And then I recalled a book that she wrote and had sent me called The $20 Christmas. And somewhere I have that as well. It's on a shelf somewhere. So these names come up in my mind. And I think of the conversations we had back then and then resurrecting them all these years later, which is part of what Throwback Thursday is all about for me. So tape after tape after tape after tape, no Lee Iacocca. Now I have about seven more Rubbermaids to look through, but I got tired. I'm like, okay, I can't just keep doing this. I ended up tossing out into the recycling bin things that weren't even marked. I'm not going to say, it would take eons for me to go listen to these unmarked tapes. So anyway, those went by the wayside. And then I started coming across names that I had done more than one show with. Steve Rizzo, who you will hear at some point. Steve Rizzo and I have probably done 10 shows over 20 some odd years. And Wayne Dyer. And Catherine Cryer. And Dorothy Hamill. And Jake Seinfeld. And all these names are popping up. And so I kind of took those and put those off to the side. And then I came across the name of Jim Boughton. There was actually two tapes for Jim Boughton. And I'm like, oh, wow, and this is a week ago. Wow, he was so great. He was a pitcher for the Yankees. He wrote a seminal work on baseball called Ball 4. And to me, Ball 4 was on the equal impact list for me as Jerry Kramer's Instant Replay, which came out in 68, I believe. So Kramer and Dick Schaap write this book called Instant Replay, and it really opened the locker room to the fans, which had not been done before. And Jerry and Dick took a lot of heat for that because, you know, you try to keep that wall up, that mystique. So Kramer and Dick Schaap write Instant Replay, and it becomes a huge bestseller. I don't know how many printings it's had. 3 years later, in 1970, Jim Boughton writes Ball 4. Similar stuff, opening up the locker room, going behind the scenes, talking about some of the greats and the antics and other things that they were up to. And this guy was crucified for this stuff back then. Now, you know, it's instant, you know, messaging on Twitter. So a very different time. I put the tape aside in my office and I thought, well, I'll have to get to that at some point. And then sadly, just yesterday, the news comes that Jim Boughton has passed away at the age of 80. And I thought, wow, I mean, I probably would have gone and digging for that tape in my mind first and hopefully I had one. But the fact that I pulled it out a week ago and here it was a little bit profound for me. And I had not listened to that tape since the interview, actually, in the year 2000, 19 years ago. So I went back first and foremost to the year 2000, to all the things that were bothering us then. You know, one of the great things about Throwback Thursday is that it gets a chance to gain a little perspective. You know, we always think that shit's hitting the fan. Well, it's hitting the fan today, but it's always been hitting the fan. And as I always say, when the shit hits the fan, it's better to be behind the fan than in front of it. But the shit's been hitting the fan ever since A, there was shit, and B, there was a fan. And we tend to forget that because we have a forgettery. We don't learn very well from history. We just kind of go with, you know, the moment we were born and forward. But the fact of the matter is, it's always been something going on. And our response to how we handle this stuff, I think, determines to a great degree if we evolve or revolve. And unfortunately, if you just roll back to the year 2000, you realize we haven't moved real far. Bucky Fuller said it this way. It's painfully obvious that our technology is surpassing our humanity. We have these great gadgets. I'm sitting here working on a Zoom machine, which wasn't even invented in 2000 when I did the show with Jim Boughton. A laptop. I didn't have a laptop. I didn't have a cell phone. So the technology, great advances. Humanology, what's up, Doc? Not so much. So just read the headlines and you see that if you roll back 10 years, 15, 20, 25, 30, 50 years, there's a pattern there. And we seem to be bent as a species on repeating the same behaviors with just different characters in it. Nothing new there. And then our response to them is the way they've always been, so it just keeps repeating itself. So I'm going to roll back real quick to the year 2000 so you could feel better about how your life is today. The average income back then was only 40 grand. The average rent, $675. And a gallon of gas was $1.26. You can get a pound of bacon for $2.97. Ground coffee was $3.44. A pound of loaf of bread, $1.72. A dozen eggs, 89 cents. That hasn't changed a whole lot. I think we got eggs for 99 cents, so big 10-cent upgrade. But one of the big things that happened, for the first time in history, a barrel of oil topped $30. That was a big deal back then. A couple of the other things that come to mind 19 years ago, mad cow disease was making serious headlines, a huge alarm in Europe because it was just out of hand. And the cows were pissed off, and the humans were pissed off, and everybody was pissed off. But even with mad cow disease, the lifespan in the United States, even though it was over there, there were concerns here, of course, because that's what we do. The lifespan in the United States hit 77 and a half, 19 years ago. And I don't know that we were living longer then. I just don't know if we were living any better. Of course, one of the big news stories of 2000 was the presidential election when Republican challenger George W. defeated Democratic Vice President Al Gore, but the final outcome was not known for over a month because of those, you know what? Bueller? Anyone? Hanging chads in Florida. You do remember? Paper ballots, and they weren't punched all the way through, determined through a court decision who was the next president of the United States. The biggest one for me, though, in 2000 was that which never took place. Because of computer technology and the Mayan calendar and geez, we've never had three zeros before. We were going to roll in from the 1900s to the 2000s. And there was widespread hysteria. So if you take mad cow disease and you stick that with the hanging chads and you add to it Y2K. If you were around then, you know what I'm talking about. Worldwide panic. What's going to happen at midnight going into the year 2000 when all these computers, all this technology that runs our lives, what happens when that rolls over? Is the world going to come to an end? I knew people who were taking money out of the bank and shoving it in their mattresses. I knew people who were, you know, hoarding gas, hoarding food, literally end of the world stuff. I found it fascinating, but also very enlightening because once again, here we are. We built all this cool machinery, but no one figured out what's going to happen when we hit the year 2000. You know what happened? Nothing. Nothing. It just was such a interesting experiment in human what? And for me personally, it launched my broadcasting in just a little bit of a different direction. I realized for some reason at that point in 2000, you know, people were going bug house, and that my forte at the time was to do 3 hours a day, 5 days a week live. And I loved it, and I thrived at it. And some days I still think that'd be a really good idea, but it takes an awful lot of energy and production and all kind of moving parts to make that happen, especially live radio. And I sat down one day and I had this thought about Y2K, and I'd never finished getting it into my show. It was probably a month or so before End of the World was coming because it was the year 2000. And I wrote a couple notes and I put the word power thoughts on top of these notes. It was just a couple things like Y2K and, you know, maybe hanging chads or whatever, because this was all going on. And these were things I wanted to work into my show, and I never had the chance to do it. And I kept that paper and then I started making more notes. And what happened from that turned into 6,785 1-minute messages called Power Thoughts that I wrote over 5-6 years. And it was something that was so interesting to me. And it helped me get into a direction where I could take what I thought was a lot of information and shove it into 59 seconds and see if I could, you know, have a beginning, a middle, and an end and make a point in a very short amount of time. And I love doing, like I said, 3 hours of radio every day. But there was something very challenging about taking an idea or a thought or trying to make a point in a very short amount of time. Some of the early ones were a little iffy. I actually had an NBC affiliate up in Michigan where I was doing radio come to me to do them on television. And somewhere in another rubber band, I'm sure, I have videotape of me looking very, very young doing these demos for TV6, WLUC-TV, TV6, Marquette, Michigan. And it was these 1-minute power thoughts. They were trying to sell them. And I don't think anything ever happened with them. But on the radio side, they did very well for a very long period of time. And those helped me roll into doing Earth Matters, which you hear on the show very often, and learning to take information that could lead to transformation, but do it in a minute or less. It was very, very cool. And what was also very cool is finding that tape of Jim Boughton. I spent the morning listening to it and editing it and cleaning it up and taking the vintage commercials out. There was some kind of, like before Viagra, there was, I don't know how these commercials got in my show, but there was stuff like Progenis or something. And it was, I should have left it in. It was friggin' hilarious. It was a man like, "Hey baby, I'm feeling really good these days." And his wife's like, "Yeah, I noticed you're so virulent. What are you doing?" "Well, I'm taking Progenis." And you don't even have to get a doctor's prescription. Oh my gosh. Some things never change. Anyway, I was very sad to hear about the passing of Jim Boughton. He was an incredible guy. And you'll hear that in this conversation. And I had such respect. Somewhere else in another Rubbermaid, I believe I have a copy of Ball 4 that Jim sent to me. He was just he was one of these guys that I think shows an incredible amount of courage to go where no other one had decided to go before. Jerry Kramer writes this book, hadn't been done before. And he was a great player in the Hall of Fame. And so here's Jim Boughton, who at one point was named one of the top 100 figures in sports history. And it wasn't so much because of what he did on the mound. It's what he had the courage to do between the covers of a book. So from December of the year 2000, Throwback Thursday, here's Jim Boughton.
I could probably read Jim Boughton's entire biography here, but it would take all the rest of the show. Let's just say this. His high school junior varsity baseball team, Jim's nickname was the Warm-Up Boughton because all he ever did was warm up. He never actually got into games. That, of course, changed later. He had aspirations of being a forest ranger, actually, and people today are still kind of having a little trouble predicting what Jim's going to do next. In 1963, he won 21 games for the New York Yankees and made the All-Star team. In 1964, Jim won 18 games and beat the Cardinals twice in the World Series. And in 1970, he wrote the classic Ball 4, the funny, irreverent, all-time bestseller, which revealed baseball players as simply, guess what, human beings. His credits go on, and I was telling Jim off the air, he's kind of my son Andy's hero because he invented, among other things, Big League Chew, and he's on the road, but he joins us this afternoon. How you doing, Jim?
Good. Nice to be here.
Thank you. Same here. You know, this the Rocky Horror Picture Show has become this cult classic that people go out to movie theaters and emulate. You know, Ball 4 has got that same draw to it. You know that, don't you?
Well, I'm finding that out as I travel around the country and do book signings. They come over with the new book, the updated version, and then they bring the paperback version out of a bag that they've been carrying, and the pages are falling out of it, and they've taped the binding, and they want me to sign it. It's like signing people's blankies.
Yeah, right. It is something about it. We go back to 1970 when the book came out. Baseball and America has changed drastically. What do you think is the allure of a book that's 30 years old? What's in there that people are hanging on to?
Well, you know, kids particularly loved Ball 4 because it gave them a glimpse into the adult world, and they discovered that the adults were not too much different than they were, and that that here were guys who were struggling, they hadn't quite figured everything out yet, scuffling, trying to make sense of the world, and gee, these were Major League Baseball players, so maybe they were not so bad off as teenagers. I think it gave them a lot of comfort. Also, kids want to know the truth about things. They want to know, okay, this is the image, but what's really happening? And that's what Ball 4 told them.
You know, interesting to me is that this was the first book, and probably to my knowledge, really the only book that does not paint the baseball players as these guys that, you know, never, as you mentioned, never have a problem, and all they do is go out and drive their sports cars and stay out till 4 o'clock in the morning. That they do have to the challenges in life. And when you did that, it really, you know, somebody said you were actually like public enemy number one because you told the truth. Do you still feel that way? Like is it still 30 years later looked at anti-establishment kind of thing? Does it still cause the ripples?
No, not at all. It started out as it was called a tell-all book, you know, by mm-hmm. sports writers who were calling me Judas and Benedict Arnold and a social leper and all that stuff.
Social leper.
And the baseball commissioner, Bowie, the Ayatollah Kuhn, said it was bad for baseball, and he wanted me to sign a statement saying that I made it all up.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, that was ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
When the book came out, I was pitching for the Houston Astros at the time, and every town we went into, every team we played, the players were screaming at me from the dugout. The fans would boo me when I got called into the game. I remember in New York City when I got called into a game to pitch in relief against the Mets. My mom and dad were at Shea Stadium, and the fans booed me, and my mom was crying. She said, maybe you shouldn't have written that book, Jim. I said, Mom, just, you know, be patient. It's not what they're saying it is. These people haven't read it yet. When mm-hmm. they read it, they're going to discover that it's a funny book. It tells the player's side of the story, and they're going to like baseball and the team and the guys. And mm-hmm. sure enough, that's what happened. I started getting letters from fans right away. I can't believe the fuss they're making over this book. I didn't find it outrageous. I like the fact that Mickey Mantle hit a home run with a hangover. It made me like him even more. It made him a human being.
Yeah.
And so people really identified with the players.
Do you think that gap has widened, Jim, especially in light of the things that have happened in the last few years with baseball, with strikes and things like that the gap between they don't seem as human anymore. Has it widened?
I think it has, at least in the perception of the fans, because they feel that the money that the players are making today is a barrier between them and the players. And this has been really the fault of the owners, who have demonized the players. Every 4 years when the collective bargaining agreement comes up, the owners talk about the players being greedy and overpaid, and the media picks up on it, and that's how fans feel about the guys. Unfortunately,
mm-hmm.
I don't know how much different today's players are than we were. I know they're more sophisticated than we are.
Mm-hmm.
They most of them have 2 or 3 years of college. They're more savvy. They handle themselves a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you read Ball 4 today, it's a time capsule look back into another time.
Mm-hmm.
We were high school kids, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, not prepared for the big league, certainly not prepared for, you know, being in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Our situation was so forlorn. We were, you know, mistreated by the owners. The minimum salary was $7,000.
Yeah.
The year I was 21-7, made the All-Star team and pitched in the World Series, my salary was $10,500.
Amazing.
We had to work in the off season
mm-hmm.
to support our baseball habits.
Mm-hmm.
Phil Lins and I and Larry Bernarth and Ed Cranepool of the Mets had a basketball team, and we would play high school faculties. They were raising money for band uniforms or whatever it was, and we got $50 a man, and we needed that money.
Wow. And what year was that, Jim?
This was in the 60s. Ball players were working as carpenters and whatever jobs they could find.
Amazing.
Because they weren't getting paid as baseball players.
Amazing.
So now it's all changed, and part of the reason it's changed is because of Ball 4,
mm-hmm.
which played a role in that. 5 years after the book came out, I don't know if you remember, but the Andy Messersmith mm-hmm. Arbitration hearing in New York,
yep.
Well, Ball 4 was part of the evidence against the owners because it was based on contemporaneous notes, and it documented the upy lifetime contracts. They should only be 1 year contracts.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's astounding to me that when you go, I mean, obviously, just going through and knowing your history a little bit, is that being a pro baseball player and a pitcher and in the World Series was pretty much against the odds for you, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, I mean, that was part of the reason why I think I was the guy to write this book, was because I never saw myself as a Major League Baseball player. I never felt I belonged there. I always felt like I had sort of snuck in there somehow, having been a bench warmer in high school. And as a result, as one of my roommates said to me, I became the first fan to ever make it to the big leagues.
That's good.
So Ball 4 really is a sort of the kinds of things that a fan would notice if they spent a summer with a Major League Baseball team.
Did you have any idea, even when you wrote the book, and even 5 years later when it was used in the court proceedings and all the stuff about arbitration, that there's all these other ramifications? There are people that are fans. We were talked off the air about the Amazon.com reviews. A lot of women read this book to get insights into the male psyche. I mean, you know, and there are people here that say it's a walk back into nostalgia for Americana for the 70s, a time that doesn't exist anymore. Is baseball that connected, or the way you portrayed baseball, that connected to the human condition?
I think, well, sports is really America's second language, for one thing. For another thing, I think the reason women like the book was because they're turned off by the statistics of the game, and mm-hmm. they're turned off by, you know, all of that stuff and winning and losing. What they're interested in is the people, the players. What are these guys like? What's that lifestyle like? What's it like for them and their families? And that's what Ball 4 revealed. Mm-hmm. So that's why it was a book that women liked. Besides, it's funny as hell. The guys yeah. are very, very funny guys. I mean, I can't take credit for this book. I was just the recording secretary.
Mm-hmm. You know, a few years back, I had the opportunity, probably somebody you may have met, Randy Hundley, used to catch for the Cubs. He runs these fantasy baseball camps,
mm-hmm.
and I had an opportunity to play in those, and it was a thrill to, you know, they take you to Wrigley Field, and I was
right.
able to catch, because I caught in high school and college, and I was able to sit back where Johnny Bench had been, and Gabby Hartnett, for God's sakes, and I got behind the plate there. That was all great, but the most fun that these guys had was in the locker room, and I know that, you know, the baby powder and the hair dryer thing, and they had a trumpet, actually, or some kind of a French horn they stuffed that had made the rookies blow on it and went in their face. But he said the same thing. He said, you know, he misses the game, but not being around those guys, like I can hear the fondness in your voice for your teammates, that's what's not in place. That also has contributed to the chasm these days, that the players aren't as close together as they used to be.
Yeah. Well, you know, we were all in the same boat, and it was sinking.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So that brought us together a lot, and of course, today's players have hotel suites on the mm-hmm. road. Some players even stay at different hotels from their teammates. We were jammed two to a room,
mm-hmm.
and the cheapest room in the hotel, if possible.
Wow. Well, you know, you must have watched baseball movies over the years. Anything captured the way you guys live when you see movies kind of like on the funny side of Major League or For the Love of the Game with Kevin Costner, or even Field of Dreams? What do you feel about that stuff?
I thought Bull Durham was pretty accurate.
Mm. You think so, huh?
Showed what the life was like, at that time.
Uh-huh. You know, I look at this, the book coming out 30 years, and there's this whole new group of young people being introduced to it. And do you hope, I mean, you kind of were blackballed a little bit in the beginning with this. Do you hope that some of the pieces of this is that kids do get connected back to baseball because it is a great game?
I would like to see that. That would be a nice thing. I know it has turned people onto baseball, not turned them off of baseball. And if that could happen with a new generation of readers, that would be wonderful.
Mm. 1978, you make a comeback to baseball with the Atlanta Braves, who are as hot as they get these days. Kind of let your TV career go because you'd come back and got on television. And you went back into the minor leagues again and went through the whole thing again and really based your life and your career on a knuckleball. What was that like to go back and kind of start over again at 39 years old?
Well, it was a crazy time in my life. I was having a midlife crisis. I needed a challenge, and a voice in the back of my head over in the crazy section said that I should see if I could make it back to the big leagues. I'd been out for 8 years, and it seemed like a fun challenge. And so I played minor league ball for 2 years with kids half my age.
Mm-hmm.
They were very nice to me. They called me Dad. And Pops, in the middle of my windup of my first comeback game, my shortstop hollers, "Come on, Mr. Boughton." But I ended up, at the end of the second year in the minor leagues, I got called up to the Atlanta Braves. I had a real good summer. I won 13 games in about 2.5 months at their Double-A team down in Savannah. But the best part about my comeback was it led to a big league chew.
That's right.
Which was invented in the bullpen when I was playing in the minor leagues in Portland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And we're sitting out in the bullpen, and I'm 39. These guys are all 18 years old. They're all chewing tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
They're playing a disgusting game called Drown the Bugs in Tobacco Juice. And we're talking about how disgusting tobacco is, and this kid sitting next to me says, "Too bad there isn't something that looks like tobacco but tastes good like gum." I said, "Hey, that's a great idea, shredded gum in a pouch. We could call it Big League Chew."
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, after the season ended, I called this kid up, and I said, "Listen, let's go partners. I'll put up the money. We'll hire a lawyer." You always have to hire a lawyer.
Yeah.
"We'll hire a lawyer and see if we can sell this idea to a gum company," and that's what happened.
Amazing. out of having a conversation in the bullpen trying to drown bugs?
I learned more in the bullpen. I learned enough in the bullpen to get me through the rest of my life.
And only half of which we can talk about on radio.
That's right.
If you like a copy of Ball 4, there's, what, 50, 60 new pages in there?
Yes, there's a new 50-page epilogue. So the book that you'll see now in the store is a hardcover edition. It's called Ball 4, The Final Pitch. It's the original book plus the 1980 update, the 1990 update, and a new 50-page epilogue in which I talk about my reconciliation with Mickey Mantle, the passing of my daughter Lori, who readers will know as the unsinkable Molly Brown in the original book.
Yeah.
My son's letter to the New York Times, my gift to me on Father's Day, in which he asked the Yankees to let bygones be bygones and invite me back. And then, of course, they did. So I've written about my return to the stadium for the first time in 28 years.
Dick Schaap, the outstanding sports writer and sportscaster, said the new 50 pages is extra special. It is the most moving and the most significant part of the book. Through these Amazon.com reviews of these women who are like firing their housekeepers that threw out their original copy. You know, I mean, it's astounding to me. They said Jim Boughton threw the ball so hard your hat would fly off. Who throws the hardest these days, Jim?
Well, it looks like Randy Johnson, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the pitchers that I enjoy watching are the craftsmen, not the overpowering guys. I like Pedro Martinez and Greg Maddux. Mm. I love to watch them work a ball game and sort of sit there and see how their minds work.
I have to write a book on, you know, I'm from Chicago originally. How is it possible that so many Cubs end up on World Series teams and they never get there? There's a whole theory there.
It's a nice training ground people find for World Series players is to spend a few years with the Cubs, but not too many.
Not too many. You could ruin your career. Who produces Big League Chew? Who actually?
It's made by a company called Amurol Products down in Yorkville, Illinois.
Yeah, I was hoping you weren't saying Wrigley because that would not be good. It wouldn't work because those guys never figure it out. You know, it's a great book. And, you know, Jim, when you're talking about baseball these days, and obviously there was a time where there was a big gap between, you know, when I was a kid, let's put it this way. When I was a kid living in Chicago, we could take the bus for about, I don't know, 15, 20 cents, go all the way down to Irving Park, get off at Addison, walk down to Wrigley Field, sit outside the bleachers. You get into the bleachers for about a buck. You bring your lunch with you. And at the end of the game, if you walked around the whole of Wrigley Field and put a row of seats up, they gave you a ticket for the next game. But the game has changed a lot. What do you see in all your years in baseball and where baseball is at? What are some of the significant changes that either help or hurt the game today?
Well, I think the things that have helped the game is that they're taking better care of the players. They have weight training now. They've got personal trainers. They count the pitches. They don't let the pitchers abuse themselves. You know, when I was pitching, I started 37 games one year.
Mm-hmm.
I completed 11 of them, which is more complete games than the entire Mets pitching staff had last year. So they treat the players today like thoroughbred horses as opposed to us, which was farm animals.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good. They protect the players more. They've got padding on the outfield walls now. They run into about a foot of foam rubber out there when they leap into the stands. We were bouncing off of cement and chain link fences and stuff.
Yeah.
So that's one of the good things. One of the things I don't like about baseball is the way they present it at the ballpark. My first experience in a major league park was when I was a kid. I went to the Polo Grounds in New York. This was in the late 40s and early 50s. And you walk into this building, and suddenly it opens up, and there's this vast, beautiful green space.
Mm.
And it's quiet. You can hear the crack of the bat on the ball, and you watch batting practice, and you can hear the thud of the fastball into a catcher's glove as a pitcher warms up on the field. You hear the players calling to each other. It's magical. Now you go into a ballpark and you're blasted with these advertising messages and silly games coming from this big screen in center field, and the music is rock music. It's pounding. It's during the game, between innings, between at-bats, between pitches sometimes. It's just disgusting.
Mm.
You know, it's like being at a rock concert or a professional wrestling venue.
And a baseball game broke out.
Yeah. And it's as if baseball is saying, you know, we really don't trust the game of baseball, so watch this big television set up here in center field.
Yeah, I never did figure that out. When the last time I took my son to the Cubbies, we sat in the grandstands, and underneath if you know how Wrigley's laid out, anybody listening, that you can sit on the grandstands. And I couldn't believe that every 15 feet there was a television hanging down.
Yeah.
Couldn't see the game.
Yeah, no, it's terrible. It's terrible. You know, they got some marketing geniuses in there who don't know what they're doing, because they're taking away the unique, what was unique and special about baseball, and they're making it like other things.
Yeah, that's right. And it is entertainment in its own right, but the entertainment, as you pointed out, is watching guys like Joe Pepitone put his white shoes on, and you can hear him tie the laces, as opposed to somebody describing how Joe Pepitone's lacing up his shoes.
Yeah.
1996, Jim Boughton received the highest honor of his career when he was featured in the Sports 100, the 100 most important people in American sports history. This book covers 150 years, only contains 21 people in the world of baseball. We're going to talk more about that. We're going to talk more about Ball 4 and what's ahead for Jim Boughton, the guy that started out as spitting on, you weren't spitting on bugs, were you, Jim?
No,
you'd never do that. No. That's where Big League Chew was born. Spending the afternoon talking with Jim Boughton. We're talking about Ball 4 and all the add-ons that are in there. Jim, you've had, you know, the thing that the book has brought out and we've talked about during this last little bit of time is that what Ball 4 did was show the human side of the heroes that we all follow. And do you think that that if we were to write a book like yours today, that it would really be able to capture what baseball has done for America? If we would go 30 years ahead now, you wrote it in 70, here we are in the year 2000, could you write a definitive book, or should there maybe write a book about knocking these walls down and portraying the people that are paid enormous amounts of money to become heroes? Should we start focusing more on the human side, do you think?
I don't know if we're going to get to know that side. I think there's too much of a barrier now between the players and the fans. There was in the old days, too. I think if a player did decide to write a diary, and he decided to commit himself to being a writer, which is what I did, and if it was a marginal player, and if he really had an observant eye and wrote everything down, I think a book like that would be interesting to fans, mm-hmm. and I think it would have a chance of humanizing the players, and God knows they could use that today more than ever before.
Yeah, a little humbling doesn't hurt, does it?
Yeah, because, people need to see that that baseball players are human beings, and it's hard to think of them that way now. They think of them as simply, you know, money machines.
Yeah. Coming from the background that you did and wanting to be a forest ranger, and among other things, do you think it's fair, or what is your take on the whole role of role models, of saying, look, here's Mark McGwire, he's done these great things, and you should be like Mark, or even be like Michael Jordan. What do you think of the sports role model concept?
I think if you look at an athlete as a role model in terms of the persistence and the hard work that it took to get there, that's good. I think if you want to capture a batting stance or a pitching motion, that's fine. I think if you look up to a player as being a special person that somehow has all the answers in life, that's a mistake. These are not special people. Baseball players, as revealed in Ball 4, certainly are really ordinary people, very ordinary people. They just happen to have special skills.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, they spent so much time developing these skills that they've neglected other aspects of themselves,
mm-hmm.
and you really have partially formed people.
Yeah.
Most athletes in the major leagues of any sport are nothing more than teenagers in adult bodies, and we should not look to them for any kind of guidance whatsoever.
Yeah, I agree.
And when one of them gets in some kind of trouble, and you know, there's more trouble to get into today than there was in my day. when they get into trouble, I don't think the kids are shocked by that. I think the people who are shocked are the media, who put them on a pedestal in the first place,
mm-hmm.
or parents who said, you know, you should look up to these players. I think kids are they're realists.
Mm-hmm.
When they see a player having a problem, they see they don't see him in uniform. They see him in street clothes. They see him in handcuffs.
Yeah.
And they see him in rehab, and they say, boy, that guy's dumb. He did a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think kids say, oh, he took drugs, therefore I can take drugs.
Mm.
I think kids, they're more savvy than we give them credit for.
The new part of the book, the updated version of Ball 4, includes things that talk about the difficulties in your life. And as you point out in the book, because we're all just human beings doing some ordinary people doing extraordinary things because of talent or skill, that we're all going to go through things, and you talk about death and loss. How has that helped, writing about it these years later, helped you to reconcile it?
Yeah, it did. I was, when I was thinking of doing this, the final chapter here, the final pitch, I just, I didn't want to write about Lori's dying because it was just too painful. I started it a number of times, and I couldn't get through it, and my wife said, you've got to do that because this has changed you. It's changed your voice. Your readers, if they've come this far, are like members of the family, and you've got to let them know, who you are today.
Mm-hmm.
And she was right, so I had to work my way through it. It took me weeks of crying and writing and crying and writing to get it done, but I'm glad I did it because I feel like it's a tribute to Lori, and also I'm hoping that people can get some things out of it for how to deal with loss in their own life.
Mm. Jim, what are we going to see from you in the future? Where are you headed? More of the same? More writing? More? Probably not a whole lot of movies, I would guess.
No, not a lot more movies, and no more TV sitcoms. No more Ball 4 either. This is the last chapter. I've called it the final pitch. I'm not mm-hmm. doing a Geezer edition in 10 more years. I'll probably do a little more writing on some other topics.
Mm-hmm.
I'll continue my motivational speaking and business opportunities when they come along. Mm-hmm. A little of this and a little of that, as Gary Bell said, and you hope it adds up to something.
Well, Jim, we wish you the best. It's been a real treat to have you on. I've been waiting almost 30 years to talk to you about this stuff, and to know that you've not only included what baseball is about, what it could be or what it should be, but also the human side about that. It's going to knock on all of our doors, that game called life, and dealing with it is essential to success in anything, so we wish you the best.
I hope so. Thanks, John. And listen, I enjoyed talking with you. Call me anytime.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.